Tonight I'd like to talk about the 14th Mishnah in Perek Beis. Him Amr Shlosha Devarim. They said three things. Rabbi Elazar Omer, Yichavot Chavercha Chav Alecha Kishalcha. The honor of your friend should be dear to you like your own. V'altinach Lechais. One should not be easily angered. V'shuv Yom Echad Lefnei Misascha. And persons should do tshuva a day prior to his demise. And one should warm himself to the light of the chachamim. But be careful with their coal. You might get burnt. Their bite is the bite of the snake. Their sting is the sting of the scorpion. Their whisper is like that of the hiss of the snake. And all the words are like burning flame. So it's really four things. Rabbeinu Yoina explains on the Mishnah that the three main points he begins with are things that he would constantly repeat, and these are things you have to know all the time. The fourth is not in that category. That's something that you don't do all the time. You have to remember every now and then, just remember your relationship with the Chacham. So Rabbeinu Yoina explains that this is simple derech eretz. The covet of your friend should be dear to you like your own. You should want that he should be respected and his things given the proper honor. A person should not be easily angered. Anger is a terrible midah. And even though it may be natural for a person to allow himself to get angry, a person has to control that. And a person should do tshuva before he dies, and the person doesn't know when he's going to die, so therefore he has to do tshuva every day. Before we analyze and get into what Rabbi Elazar said, remember we were going through the Talmidim of Yochanan Zakkai. We began by saying that Yochanan Zakkai had five major Talmidim, and they were Elazar ben Hyrcanus, Moshe ben Chananya, Yossi HaKohen, Moshe ben Asana, Elazar ben Aruch, and he would go through their praises, and he would say, if all the Chachmei Yisrael were in one balance of a scale, and Elazar ben Hyrcanus was in the other, Elazar ben Hyrcanus would outweigh them all. Elazar ben Hyrcanus was almost like in a different league. Elazar ben Hyrcanus had a fascinating story, and we mentioned it briefly the last time we met, and I'll go through the Maisa more in depth. Elazar ben Hyrcanus was 22 years old, v'lo lamad Torah. At the age of 22, he was a total ignoramus. He had not learned Torah. And his father, Hyrcanus, was a very well-known Ashir. He was a very wealthy man, many fields, many vineyards. And he divided up his fields to his sons and gave each one a parcel to be responsible for the plowing and the planting. And Rebbe Lezer's portion was full of rocks. And one day, Hyrcanus comes to check on the fields and he sees his son Eliezer crying. So his father said, "Bepneata boche, why are you crying? Are you upset that the fields I gave you had rocks? I'll give you fields that don't have rocks." So he gives him a different field, a better field. Comes another time to check on him, and he sees him crying. He says, "Now why are you crying?" So Elazar said, "I want to learn Torah." His father said, "You're 22 years old. How are you going to go learn Torah now? Get married, have children, and your children will go to yeshiva. They'll learn Torah. For you, it's too late. But your kids will learn Torah." Gave him another field. And as he's plowing with this new field, his cow that was schlepping the plow fell and broke a leg, which meant it had to be put to sleep. And Elazar said, "This is for my benefit." Elianovi shows up and sees him crying. Elianovi says to him, "Why are you crying?" He says, "I want to learn Torah." So Elianovi said to him, "If you want to learn Torah, go to Yerushalayim to be Yochanan Zakkai. You learn by him." It's a fascinating thing. Because you think somebody didn't learn, he's 22 years old, so go to a Malamed, go to a Rav. Eliyahu Hanavi appeared to him as a person, go to the Gadol Hador. Go to the greatest leader of the generation. And then you learn Torah from him. So Rabbi Elazar ran away. He ran away from home. He went to Yerushalayim. He comes to Yochanan Zakkai, and Yochanan Zakkai says, "Who are you?" He didn't want to tell him. Everyone knew his father. His father was a very wealthy man, a very prominent person. Didn't say who his father was. Didn't say us. "Do you know how to learn anything? Do you know Kriyishma, Tefillah, Birchas Hamazon?" He says, "No, I don't know." It was really a pal when you think about it. how would he not know to daven? So I once heard it explained that he really was dense. They tried, and this never went in. They tried and tried, and they gave up on him. This person gave up on him. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai says, Kriyishma, davening, benching? No. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, I'll teach you those three things. I'll teach you how to bench, I'll teach you Shemoneh Esrei, I'll teach you Kriyishma. So he teaches to him, and he sees that he's crying. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai says, why are you crying? He says, I want to learn Torah. So he would teach him two halachas a day. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai would teach him two things a day. And he would sit and review them all day long. Yeah, he was a weak head, I don't know, and he'd spent all day reviewing those two things. Two things a day, and he sat and reviewed all day long. 8 days, he was Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, and nothing to eat. He didn't have a place to stay, didn't know where to go. He was fasting for 8 days. And by 8 days, the way the Medrash brings it, he had terrible breath. And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai was like, oh, it smells terrible, and they told him, go to the side. No, don't sit in front of the Rebbe. Sit on the side. And he started crying. So he says, why are you crying? He says, you put me on the side like I have shechin or something. So Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai says, no, don't worry. The same way this bad breath is coming from your mouth, so too the reich of Torah will also come from your mouth from one end of the world to the other. So he said, who are you? Who are you? And he said, I'm the son of Hyrcanus. So they said, you're the son of one of the Gedolei Olam and you didn't tell me? You're going to eat by me. So he said, I already ate. Rabbi Shu ben Chananya and Beis Yakain. Yochanan Zakkai was smart and he checked. Did he eat by you? No, didn't eat by us. And they found out that he hasn't eaten in 8 days. So he stayed with Yochanan Zakkai. He didn't want to. He didn't want to pose on anybody, and he didn't want to. So, he began to learn from Yochanan Zakkai, and he stayed there for months, for years, and eventually the other brothers who were left home busy with the fields were very upset that we're doing all the work and where's Eliezer? So they went to the father who said, "You know, look at this Eliezer. He ran away. You're an old man. He abandoned you. You should just." Disown him from your property. You should make a net and disown him from your property. So he decided to go to Yerushalayim to disown him. He'll find him in Yerushalayim someplace and he'll disown him. So when he comes to Yerushalayim, of course he starts with Yochanan Zakkai because he's the Nasi. And all the Gedolei Yerushalayim are there. Nachtiyah Ben Gurion, Metzitz Akeses, and Kal Basua, all the wealthy people. And when the word came that the father of Eliezer was showing up, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, make place for Rabbi Eliezer to be here. And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said to Rabbi Eliezer to say the Torah. So Rabbi Eliezer was hesitant. And he said, am I just supposed to say over what you taught me? Am I supposed to say over other things? And Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, say your own chidushim, it's fine. Whatever the Torah. But he was embarrassed to speak in front of Yochanan Zakkai. So Yochanan Zakkai said, I'll stand on the side. So Yochanan Zakkai goes to the side, and Rabbi Eliezer gets up, and he says, a drasha. And his face shone like the sun, and the words he said were bright like when they're given on Sinai. And Yochanan Zakkai came from behind, and he kissed him on the head, said, Ashreichem, Avam Yisrael, and Yankov, that you have such a Rabbi Eliezer who came from you. So Hyrcanus says, who is this? Who are you praising like that? Who is this person that's saying this amazing drasha? Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai said, it's your son Eliezer. So Hyrcanus said, then fortunate am I that have such a child. And he stood up and said, Rabbeisai, I came to Yerushalayim to disown my son Eliezer. But now that I see his chacham and his Torah, he gets all my property and his brothers get nothing. So Rabbi Eliezer said, if I would have wanted property and silver and gold, I would just ask the Ribbono Shel. He would give me. L'Hashem ha'aretz u'milayo. I don't need it. All I want is Torah. Like it says, Tov li Torah espicha me'af yizal v'chesef. Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus began as a total ignoramus, you know, similar to the Rabbi Akiva story, but he was younger when he was committed to learn, and it wasn't through his wife. He just on his own, he wanted a golden Torah. And he became so great that when it came time for him to die, his students, which included Rabbi Akiva, he said, "You've taken from me, like, you know, nothing compared to what I have to give. It's like a drop in the bucket or in the sea of what Torah knowledge that I have that I have not been able to share with you." He was a living Sefer Torah. In the description, he said, "My arm," it's like he describes himself that way. A whole different level of Torah knowledge and what he knew and what he could have taught and what he didn't, because not everyone came to him. He was controversial later in his years. He was arguing the Chachamim and disagree against all of them. This is a story, I'm sure you know the story with Tana Shel Achnoi, when he said, "You disagree with me, the palm tree will prove it, the river will flow backwards, the walls of Beis Medrash will collapse." That's everybody's in hopeness. You know, he stood up for what he believed in, and the Chachamim felt he went too far sometimes, but his beginnings were very humble. And this is the Rebbe Elazar Horkanis, who's from the great Talmid Rav Zakkai, that you put him in the balance, it would override everyone else. And he came to say three things. That's what the Mishnah says. Three things he would teach people to regularly teach them. Yichavod chavercha chavod lechishulcha. You have to be careful with your friend's kavod. You have to be particular with what they need. And we've said in the past, at what point in time we've said it here, but I'm sure we have, that kavod is a terrible thing. A person should run away from kavod, but you have to know kavod, because you have to know what to do for others. Chaim Shmuel Levitt says, the reason kavod is in the world, Ramchal says, kavod is terrible. Yoavim ben Nevat was destroyed because of kavod, and Koyach was destroyed because of kavod. There's just bad things come from kavod. So why is it here at all? Because we have to know how to give kavod. If to take it is poison, but to give, you have to know how to give kavod. You have to know what it is to honor others. So a person has to be focused on kavod chaveroi, and you know, it's something I heard many years ago. It was in probably some kind of class for Shalom Bayis. A lot of Shalom Bayis classes. Unfortunately, when we consider giving Shalom Bayis classes, people come to the Shalom Bayis classes. No, the people who need it don't come, the people who come don't need it, but there are things you can learn. If a person is thirsty during the course of a meal and they get up and get a cup of water, automatically get a cup of water for your spouse. As if you're thirsty, probably the other person with you is also thirsty. If I'm at a chasna and they have a bar where they have pops, you know, you're sitting at the table, they have water, and they have, you know, soda at the corner. Generally, I don't know at other tables, but at the Rabbanim table, almost always, if someone gets up, he comes back with two cups. A cup for himself and a cup for some person next to him. He'll ask Rabbi Zonza, "What do you want? Do you want diet?" And I'll come back. Why should I come back with one cup? Come back with two cups. And it's that way at home. If you're thirsty, probably someone sitting next to you is thirsty too. And if you're getting yourself a drink, get your wife a drink or get your husband a drink. It's unlikely that you're the one who's thirsty and they're not. So if you're doing it already, get two. That's like part of this concept. Try to think in terms of the people around you, not just in terms of yourself. Again, it probably is a madrega. It is a madrega because when you're a child, you only think about yourself. And that's part of maturing. Part of growing up is you're not the center of the universe and there are other people and you have to treat them nicely as well. I came across a fascinating story that Chaim Avad Yosef says over in this on this Mishnah. Avikavet chavercha chavav alech kishlecha. You know, when we think of big disagreements that take place in a city between the Rabbanim and Rosh Hashivas, we could think about financial disputes, we could think about corruption, or worse things. It says a story that occurred in the city of Lublin. And the Rav of the city was the Maharam. The Maharam appears in the back of the Gemara. He has notations on Rashi and Tosfos. He was Rosh Hashiva, he was the Rav. And there was another yeshiva in the same city, and the Rosh Yeshiva there was the son-in-law of Marshal. In the back of the Gemara of Yeshiva Bach, you know, there's a commentary called Marshal. On the bottom is the Maharam and Marshal. They all lived around the same time. Marshal. Shlomo Luria. Marshal was older of the three. Marshal and Maharam were basically contemporaries, and Marshal was like the previous generation. So in Lublin, the Rav was Maharam, and the son-in-law of Marshal was a Rosh Yeshiva. So there were two yeshivas. And there was a Shiloh on how to explain Tosfos. So Maharam said a long pilpul to explain Tosfos. But the other Rosh Yeshiva said, no, there's a mistake. It's missing a Vav. You put on a Vav, and everything is taken care of. So this became this huge machlokes. Is the Pshat and Tosfos the way the Maharam said, leave the text the way it is, or do you have to add a Vav? And once you add a Vav, everything is for Enfret. It doesn't say which Tosfos it is, but that was the machlokes. And the Talmidim were arguing back and forth, and it came to the point that said, we're going to go to Amsterdam, and we're going to talk to the Rav of Marash Abu Hab, and ask him, what's the Pshat and Tosfos? And if he says, like, either one of the Rosh Hashivas, the other one has to resign his post. Rav Machlik is how to explain Tosfos. So they go to Amsterdam, and the Marash Abu Hab says, you got to add a Vav. You got to add a Vav. It's just a mistake. Add a Vav, and everything is good. So Maharam, who was the Rav and the Yeshiva, stepped down. Okay, I resign. I resign my post over this Machlokas, and the other Rosh Yeshiva was very upset. He said, this is ridiculous. Why is he has to resign? Because Bishal's like me. So he said, if you don't instate him, I'm resigning too. And the Kehila said, listen, that deal's a deal. So he resigned. So now the city has no Rosh Yeshivas, no Rabbanim. So they're looking for a Rav. So they send a letter to the Marsha, who was in a different city, and they say, come be our Rav. And the Marsha understood what happened. So he says, fine, I'll come. He comes to Lublin, and they tell him that you have to give a big drasha the first Shabbos you're here. And everyone comes to the drasha, and the Marsha gives an amazing, fascinating drasha. And then he says like this, I have a problem, I have a kasha. You sent me a letter to be your Rav, and the city that I was in is twice as big as the city. Lublin is a small town compared to where I was. So what are we thinking? Why would you think I would leave the Rabbonis in the big city that I was in to come here to Lublin? And Lachoris is a kasha on me too. Like, why would I even come? Why would I accept the position if I was in a city so much bigger than Lublin? So the answer is, it's simple why I came. In the whole city I was, which is twice as big as Lublin, there's no two balabatim like Maharam and the other Rosh Yeshiva. It's people like that. I don't have people like that in my town. So for sure, I'll come to the city. Why wouldn't I come to the city? But the kasha is on you. Why did you think I would come? Why did you invite me to think I would come to the city when I'm in Ibrov in a much bigger city than this? So he said, the fact is, you sent me the Ksav bonus. You accepted me as the Rav. You have to listen to me. I'm making a decree. The Maharam gets back his position, and the other Yeshiva gets back his position, and you have to listen, because you accepted me as the Rav. And they each got back their jobs, and he left town. He went back to his city. So, Chavadisa said, that is Kavod Chavercha Chavolach Kasholcha. To me, it's fascinating. That's how they both lost their jobs over a fight and how to explain a Tosfos. Once upon a time, that was worth a lot. What was Pshat and Tosfos?
That
somehow they made this deal that they're going to go to the city of Amsterdam and ask the big gadol there, and whatever he says goes. I guess they must have been young Rosh Hashivas. I don't know. It's, to me, the whole thing's mind-boggling. I can't really put myself in, like, how does this come to that? If you didn't get the right pshat and tosfos, you have to resign your position? Well, you could say it was a struggle in MS. They want to know what was the MS. What is the Torah saying? And they got into this machlekes. But, there's many disagreements in pshat and tosfos. It's not going to come to a duel, so to speak, and see who's going to end up winning, and the other one has to resign. And the other yeshiva wasn't masking. He says, I don't agree. If you don't put him back, I'm resigning. They both resigned. Until the Marshal reinstated them. He said, this is ridiculous. And he put them both back in their positions. But this is the idea of trying to think of how to give cover to someone else, and you know, obviously trying to do what's right at the same time. It's a valuable thing, and again, Rav Elazar said this is something you have to review constantly. The next thing he said is "Al tinarch lichais." Do not be quick to get angry. Now, Chazal are replete with descriptions of how terrible it is to get angry. The Gemara says that if a person gets angry and breaks something in anger, it's ke'ilu he's oved avodah zarah. The Gemara says if a person gets angry, he'll forget his Torah. The Rambam says that a person is supposed to try to find the medium path, you know, middle of the road in all the characteristics of a person. But when it comes to kas, there's no middle of the road with kas. It's like gaiva and kas. You stay far away from kas. You try to stay far, far away. And Rabbi Yonah says it's a challenge. It may be a natural inclination to get angry, and a person has to learn to conquer his kas. A person has to learn not to be upset. And the Gemara teaches us the famous words, how do you judge a person? Bekisa, bekesa, bekasa. How does he get angry? What happens when he gets upset? And it doesn't need explanation why it's a bad thing to get angry and why a person in the Parsha of Shaduchim wants to make sure that this fellow does not have an anger problem, an anger management problem, we call it nice things today, temper, you know. These are concerns. Does a person have control of his emotions, that he doesn't get upset, doesn't get bent out of shape over things? Why do people get angry? Why do people get angry? So, people get angry when things don't go the way they want it to go. When they're expecting something and their expectations are not met, they get upset. They get upset. If a person has his expectations and expects them to be met all the time, he's going to be prone to anger. And the real question is, why does he have these expectations? And why does he expect things to go his way? And therefore get so upset when things don't go his way. And for the most part, it's probably correct to say that people with poor self-esteem and poor coping skills are going to be quicker to get angry and upset when things are not the way they expected it to be. Because someone who is happy with himself and someone who knows how to cope, yeah, so things didn't work out the way I planned. That's okay. Life goes on. We'll manage. It's not like their whole world came to an end. It's not like some horrible event had just occurred. For some people, it's to me, it is mind-boggling. It's literally mind-boggling. And I feel bad for these people. They come into shul, someone is sitting in their seat. They storm out and walk home. They'll knock down with a minion. There's five seats empty, right around where their seat is. They can sit in any one of those seats. Someone's in my seat. Walks out the door, slams the door behind them. Goes. So Rachmanis on him, so Rachmanis on his wife, Rachmanis on his kids. Why can't he just like sit down one seat next to him, one seat behind the ones? It wasn't pshat, there were no seats, and there are plenty of seats, there's plenty of places, but why can't a person? So it's Rachmanis, so really it's Rachmanis. That's, I think, the one who isn't angry when you're confronted with someone, because obviously to tell them, don't be angry, does not work. That's just going to get them more upset. They'll never work. Don't be so upset. Don't get so upset. You know, if in their mind there's a reason to be upset, so of course it's going to be upset. Don't tell them not to get upset. In fact, I feel bad for them. I feel bad for them. It's sad. It's sad they can't control that. And it's something that people have to work on, some people have to work hard, some people don't have to work as hard. But ultimately, I think the people who need things to be just so and get so benefit, but it's not, are the people who themselves are not so put together, or not so, don't feel good about themselves, and therefore they are prone to this. So this is something that we have to be aware of, and something that on a personal level we have to work on, both on the level of controlling ourselves and in how we relate to people who don't have such good control of themselves. There is a mashal that Chaim Avraham Yosef brings just to, you know, encapsulate this concept of Al tinoach lechais, of don't be so quick to get upset. He says, you know, kids play, and you can have a kid who builds himself a Lego house, fort. It could be with blocks, Lego, or whatever. And you all know what the older sibling does. They come and break it. Or another kid will break it. And the little kid's devastated. And they come screaming to their parent. You have to punish him. He has to get a patch. Look what he did. He broke my thing. That doesn't mean the one who broke it's a tzaddik. It doesn't mean the one who broke it shouldn't be dealt with. But the parent is probably not going to deliver punishment that's satisfactory in the eyes of the child whose fort was destroyed. Because as far as they're concerned, this kid should be grounded for a week and lose their allowance and get patched and whatever. Like, it's terrible what they did to my thing. But a parent knows it's nothing. It's garnished. No one got hurt. It's okay. I mean, it wasn't right that they did it, and they have to be dealt with accordingly, appropriately. But in the big scheme of things, it's garnished. When things happen in our lives that we're upset about, and maybe someone did something to us, and maybe someone collapsed our little tower, so to speak, and we're really upset, and we're expecting Rebbe Hashem is going to take care of that person. What they did, anti-Semite, what he did to me, Rebbe Hashem is going to take care of them. In the big scheme of things, it's probably garnished. It's really nothing. It's like the kid kicking over the other kid's toy. And it doesn't deserve serious consequences. Not saying it was a nice thing and not saying that they were right, but usually we can overreact into thinking it's more than what it is. So what do people say? They say, count to 10 before you get upset, before you scream, before you this, before you react. Catch your breath. You may come to realize yourself that it's garnished. In the big scheme of things, it's nothing. This is not worth getting angry about. And I suspect most, if not almost all things are like that. They're just not worth getting upset about. And, you know, there is something to just putting everything in perspective in that way. There are some things that the Rambam says, and the Sifrei Musar say, that you should get upset about. But you're not supposed to be upset. So they say to pretend to be upset. You're not really upset, but you pretend to be upset. And the Gemara gives examples like this. To convey to your family or your kids, this is not right. This is not acceptable. And you put on a show of being angry, but it has to be a show. It's very difficult. It's very difficult to pretend to be angry and not get angry. Because when you get all upset, you know, start screaming, you end up getting angry. And many years ago, I tried it once. In Beis Yaakov. One time I tried it, before all your times. Long time ago. I never did it again. One time I tried to pretend to be angry. And I felt a little bit, I was getting angry. And the students were just... so what was the devil? What was the terrible was? What was it? Maybe I had to repeat myself 3 times instead of 2 times. And like I slammed. What do you think? I just keep saying over and over, you're not listening. And I calculated in head, and as it was all thought out, I probably have to put on a show to show that I'm angry, this is not right. And it was so upsetting to the students in the room, I think, I can't do this anymore. And I've never done it again. I know there are teachers who will get angry all the time, but that's I don't feel that that's productive. Any question?
What about, like, getting angry on behalf of somebody else? like sometimes you see like someone being walked over or something happening to someone else and they're like too like passive or like they have too much cover to react on it when it really shouldn't happen to them. Is that like, I don't know, because it's not the same type of anger as being angry about your own kabo. It's like
if something is upsetting, not that someone did something wrong to you or whatever, but there's something upsetting. There's something
right.
wrong.
There are things that are wrong and upsetting, and you can respond to it without kas. It doesn't require kas. Kas is kind of losing it. When we say, we're talking about kas, we mean like losing control. It's essentially losing control. When a person is bekas, they're not in control. I've heard this many times. Even if a parent has to discipline a child, not out of anger. When you're calm and relaxed, you can take the child and explain to them, you did this wrong, you're getting a punch now. And you put him on your knee and you give him a whack. But not out of anger. Because when you're angry, that could turn into abuse. You want to do mishpat? Mishpat. Mishpat is calm and relaxed. It may take time. These are concepts that may be foreign, but not to discipline a child out of anger, because you're not going to do the lesson of discipline when you're angry. So anger is losing yourself. You're not describing. You're describing something. It's like righteous indignation. Something is wrong. You witness something wrong. It's not right. It's got to be addressed. But you can address it without kas. It doesn't require kas to address a wrong. To work to right something wrong doesn't need kas. It's not the same usage of the word.
Isn't upset and kas just not the same thing? Upset and angry?
Kas is also upset. It means when I talk about kas, when they're talking about kas, they're talking about losing self-control. That's what they're talking about, not losing self-control. You're not in self-control when you're bekas. If you're pretending to be bekas, you might be. But if you're really bekas, you're not. You're not in control. When a person walks out of shul because someone's in his seat,
that's angry.
That's losing control. It doesn't make sense. Right? To my mind, that's losing control. He didn't scream and shout and push someone out. That's illogical. It's irrational.
You get a bad day and be upset.
Well, again, being upset for a bad day, it's garnished. It's a mosquito bite. What are you upset about? You upset when a mosquito bites you? Not happy about it. Not happy about it, but it's a mosquito bite.
And is frustration the same thing?
Depends how you use the word frustration. In my mind, frustration is Adam la'amal yulot. Amal is frustration. Man is born to toil and be frustrated in his toil. That's what this rule is all about. The way Yerucham says it is, people think life's supposed to go smooth and every now and then is a wrench. It's the opposite. It's just the opposite. Life is the wrench in the works. So every now and then it goes smooth. That's the anomaly. That's not the norm. That's Adam Amal Yulot, he says. Adam Amal Yulot means things don't go easy in this world. Things do not go easy in this world. I recently saw a quote. It was a Divrei Chochma. It wasn't a Jewish source. Life is a shipwreck, but don't forget to sing in the life raft. Things go wrong. Things go wrong. But you can make do, and you can be happy making do. Whereas it doesn't have to
be miserable. Physical pain is inevitable, suffering is optional.
That's another way of putting it. That's another way of putting it. Yes.
Are you allowed to take medicine that will
calm you?
No. Might make someone like angry or depressed or
medication whose side effects will make you moody? I mean, a lot of people take these medications. That's a decision that has to be made with, you know, a lot of forethought and why I'm taking it and why I need it and if the side effects are acceptable or not. I cannot say don't take them because some people need these medicines.
You don't, a lot of people don't know before they take it. They know
right.
They don't know how they're going
to
react.
Right, so afterwards they have to decide if the people around them want them to continue or not.
But you're allowed to take it to see how you react to it?
If someone has a need for medication and there are potential side effects, most people will take the medication. I mean, if you start reading all the small script on all the some things are like
Right, but there are some medicines that that you know people are more likely to react badly to.
Right. It doesn't mean we don't do it. Doesn't mean we don't do it. There's a fascinating like addendum to this conversation about not being upset and not being angry and waiting. You know, if you see something upsetting, wait a day. Chaim Avadya Yosef brings a Sefer Chassidim of this fellow whose father was a chassid, and he told him before he died, if you ever get upset about something, don't do anything for 24 hours. Sleep on it. Sleep on it. You know, there's a discussion or ponderings, musings. Why does Hashem make it that we sleep? We have to sleep. The Gemara says if you go 3 days, you for sure are going to sleep. First makes a ned, I won't sleep for 3 days. It's a ned to shav. It's impossible. You're going to have to sleep. We have to sleep. Why do we do that? So much waste of time. So much time is wasted. I could be so much more productive if I didn't need to sleep.
Yeah, but you have brain overload from all the information.
So that's how Hashem made us that way. But why? Why did he make it that way? Like, so I once heard, if a person wouldn't sleep, his bad day would never end. You have a bad day. You have a bad day. You go to sleep. Tomorrow's a new day. You just get up. It's a new day. And it really is. It really is a new day. And if you still remember, you remind yourself of your bad day yesterday, by 2 days, it's for sure gone. So the Sefer Chassidim says, this man told his son, sleep on it. Don't react to anything that gets you angry. So fine. So he gets married, his father passes away, and he has a wife, and they have no parnasa, and she says, why don't you go abroad and make some money and come back? So he does, he leaves his wife, and he goes, and he's away for 2 years, or 3 years, or 4 years, or 5 years, I don't know how long it is, and he comes back, and it's evening time. And he comes to his house, and he sees this boy in the house with his wife, and she's hugging and kissing, and he's so upset, he's going to take his sword and kill them both and kill himself. And as he pulls out his sword, he remembers his father told him, don't get angry. So he goes to the city park, and he goes to sleep in the park. And the next morning, he goes to Minyan, and then some people remembered who he was. And they tell the boy that he saw them last night with his wife, go give Shalom Aleichem to your father. She was pregnant when he left. He didn't even know. It was his son. So he says, everybody wanted to remember what my father told me. I would have killed my wife, I'd killed my son, killed myself. Without realizing. It's a little drastic kind of story. But the message is, you sleep on it, things will be better in the morning. Now, I will add that I personally believe that if there's ever a dispute between husband and wife, it should be resolved before you go to sleep. Don't sleep on an argument. Things in life in general that upset you, by the next day they won't be so bad. But I don't think it's worth letting a disagreement smolder and fester between husband and wife. I believe even if it means staying up to 1-2 in the morning, let it get resolved before you go to sleep that night. It's not worthwhile going to sleep angry.
Both parties are just exhausted and sleep would just make it better.
Well, if the husband will apologize to his wife, I'm sure that will resolve it 1-2-3. Right? So.
Maybe not.
Usually, yes. In any event, it's not. I don't think it's worth having a disagreement among spouses last through the night. But in any event, that's what he says. So spend the night on it. So after that, he quotes an Arizal. And to me, this was a little mind-boggling. The Arizal says, he quotes the Arizal. He was very makbid on the chet of kas more than any other chet. And he explained the reason. For any chet you do, so your neshama suffers. You have a neshama, your neshama suffers. And you're going to have to fix it up. By kas, your neshama leaves. And you get a different neshama. Your neshama is not hanging around. Anger, I'm out of here. And he has the sources, Alpi Kabbalah, whatever it is. And that's why the Gemara says that Tamid HaChacham forget their learning when they are angry. Moshe Rabbeinu forgot the halacha when he was angry. He says, why do you forget himself when he's angry? Because his neshama said goodbye. And so then the question, what do you get back afterwards? So he says it could be you have to start from scratch and all the mitzvahs you did were gone because they want the Hashem and wherever it is it is, and maybe you do get it back. And he says his Talmud Chaim Vital was also very makbid, more than any other chet, more than any other chet. And the bottom line is, on a ruchnius level, like this idea of losing yourself, the Arizal took it to a whole new level. You really do lose yourself. And it's a frightening thought. So his lashon is, even if you did many mitzvahs and many tikkunim, you could lose it all in that instant of anger. It's like ma'abed olam b'sha'acha, so you can lose your world in an instant. So kas is a really bad thing. If you had to work on something, it's really important to have anger under control. If you have a problem with it, there are tools, and there's anger management and all kinds of stuff like that. But it's really a bad thing. It's not just bad for yourself and not just bad for the people around you in the realm of your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I mean, very few chatorim, the Gemara says, it's as bad as doing Avodah Zarah. A person gets angry and breaks something, it's like doing Avodah Zarah. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say like that, like most. You know. There are a lot of avarice in the Torah. We don't say it's like Avodah Zarah. Many things a person does because of taiva, we understand. Is it taiva? Okay. No, because of taiva, he has to control his taiva. People have to control themselves. And whether it's money, or whether it's women, or whatever, okay, you have to control your mensch. But kas is a whole different level when it comes to kas. So, again, it doesn't mean being frustrated or upset about things that don't work out the way you expected. That's natural. But to lose control when that happens, it's almost like it's debilitating. That's the problem. That's a problem, and a person has to master it. A person has to master it. And ultimately, it may come from learning Musar, it may come from working on themselves in different ways. But, you know, I think once a person doesn't get angry when he would have gotten angry, it's easier the next time. I'm not saying it's an easy thing not to get angry when you really are angry, but it's not impossible. This is not something that is impossible. And again, whether you in your mind tell yourself it's not me, they have issues or whatever it is, it's a circumstance, however you want to remove yourself from the picture that you shouldn't get upset or overly upset, you can work on that. But this is something that's very important. And that's what we constantly repeated. That's what we constantly say. Be careful with defense covered. Don't be narach lechais. And the final thing he would say all the time is do tshuva on a regular basis. Shuvim erech lechim sascha. People say, Ribbono shel Olam, before they go to sleep in Kriyat Shema L'Amita, the Meichel people, they get Mechila. A person has to always be aware, we're not here forever. We don't know how long we're here for. And we have to constantly do the best we can. And as whenever we're confronted with tragedies, news of tragedies, and it's very upsetting, we have to do the best we can. That's what the Rebbe wants from us. We do what we can. We don't have to go overboard. We know we're here. We're reminded every now and then. We're not here forever. So you have to make sure to make the best of the time that you have. The final thing he says, I'm not going to get into great length, this idea of warm yourself by the aura of the Chacham, but don't get burned. It's kind of like the idea of familiarity breeds contempt. When you get really close to some people, then all of a sudden like you don't respect them as much. When you're dealing with Chacham, great people, you got to keep that respect up. You can't let it down and say, like, we're buddies. You're not buddies. To the extent that they let you get close, they let you get close, and you'll learn from them, and you'll watch them, and you'll observe them, but never take for granted. Don't put them down on your level. Don't think that these are my friends. Person has to keep that sense of moira, so to speak, that sense of awe and kavod always in place. And again, I'm not saying it's easy either if you become like a ben bias or close to these people, but that I think that's the concept that I was trying to say. And again, this is not something that needs constant repetition. It's not something which comes up all the time. But it's something which is important. The way Chaim Avad Yosef puts it, he basically says, a person has to always be careful to cover Chacham. If sometimes Chacham just give a psak that you're not happy with, you can't be upset. You can't say weird things about them. You can't malign a Chacham for saying something you don't understand, that you don't agree with, you don't appreciate what they're saying. You have to be careful. These are great people. we don't understand necessarily everything they're saying or where they're coming from. We have to give them that proper, they're not our friends. The people you want to get close to, people you get warmed by their Torah, by their fire, but don't take advantage, so to speak, or presupposition where you get burned, which could happen. It could happen. I've seen it. I don't know how shaykh is with girls, but I've seen it with fellows.
This isn't my thought. I don't know how I feel about it. I'm just asking. Mm-hmm. A lot of people feel that, I don't know if this is what it's talking about, people get so close with their rabbis that, like, they ask them questions for every single move of their life and don't make their own decision. Is that what this is talking about? Is that right? Or is that
It's not, there's no problem per se in from the Mishnah's concept of asking a Rebbe anything. People have to be comfortable enough to ask and shouldn't be embarrassed, blah, blah, shalom, and so on. But sometimes there are people who won't do anything without asking, and maybe that's not the greatest thing. I really believe ultimately there's a divide between Hasidim and not Hasidim in this area. That among the Hasidim, I think it's more common not to make a move without asking. And by non-Hasidim, it's not so much that way. Rav Shira Zichron Livracha was a Bacher. He had some big questions for him. He's a genius, and he has his questions. And as Rav Yosef said, let's go ask the Rebbe. We'll ask the Rebbe. Anyone have any questions? And he said, I think the Rebbe Hashem is happier that I have my questions than if I go to the Rebbe and get the answers. So that's a non-Hasidic approach. Maybe I'm better off having my questions, and I'll work on them, and I'll work it through, and I'll come up with a conclusion. And they say, I don't know if I experienced it myself, but I've heard it said that when a bacher or a yevaman, someone would come to Rav Shira Zichron Livracha with a question, he would insist that the fellow work out an answer before he discussed it with him. What would you answer? What are your sides? What are you? And once he worked it out, he'll either show you the flaw in your logic or agree with your logic. But in life, not just in life, if someone had a question, he wouldn't just give you an answer. Because that was his approach. You have to use your head. You can't just blindly. Now again, in some things, maybe we have no choice and we have to. But in other things, it's not that way. In other words, I'm not saying it's bad if someone asks every little thing, but I think it's a different kind of culture than I'm used to. So it could be by Hasidim, it's more common, and by Nachasidim, it's less common.
But I learn that this time.
Do it also. Because we're influenced by the Hasidic world.
No, I that too, but I've heard a lot of people complain about the non-Hasidic world. Like,
don't do anything without asking.
Yeah.
It's an easy thing to say about people who don't find them long
enough. I would say the flip side is the other way. I've heard so many people don't have rebellion today. I think it's wonderful they have a Rebbe to go to. I keep hearing complaints the other way. There's so many guys there without a Rebbe. Because they go to yeshivas for 2 years here, 2 years here, 2 years here, they never get a Rebbe. It's not like you sit in one place for 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So if someone actually has a Rebbe, maybe that's a good thing in its own right. That they have someone to go to. But, you know, if you want to share your life with somebody who asks Shabbos for every little thing, you just have to make sure you're comfortable with the person he asks. That's all.
You could call the hotline.
What hotline?
Some
people that are Rebbe don't do unless they hear what they like.
I think a hotline is worse because then you get like a general answer that doesn't take into account your specific situation.
Yeah, that's not good.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
I hear many times from women whose husbands don't have Rebbe, and it's very frustrating for them. Very frustrating.
Just curious, what if you have a Rebbe?
Who's you? A girl?
Yeah. Right. The girl's a rabbi, then right. Why does the...
What happens when she gets married? She goes by her husband's rabbi. Unless her husband's maskim. It's a given. A woman follows her husband, and he's going to be the one to ask the shilas. And you have to come to some kind of agreement with that. Or, you know, an acceptance of that. And if you don't agree on that you have to discuss up front. It's very uncommon for a married couple where a woman has her rabbi and he has his rabbi. It's a little unusual. Sometimes they both agree to go to her rabbi. Sometimes they don't. In which case, to go to his rabbi. That is the norm in Klal Yisrael. Just like a girl goes up in her father's house, and when she gets married, everything she saw by her father is out the window. Now it's what her husband. And lighting Shabbos candles, it's not her mother's minute, it's her husband's mother's minute.
Really?
And if that gets you nervous, find out what her minute is before you start dating. But yeah, it goes, if a woman lights two candles and her son is dating, his wife is only two candles.
Like, even I light candles my entire life, but even once I get married, it's...
Your kids will do what his minig is, not what your minig is. Now, it used to be people married through the same and hug them, so that's wonderful, but it doesn't always work the way today. So that's something, and we talked about premarital counseling. Discuss in advance, what do you do when there's a conflict of minhag? I think one of the serious things to discuss in advance is gebrokst, not gebrokst. It's a big issue. It's a big issue. I know girls. That's right. I know a girl's family who they eat knedels, and the son-in-law does not, and the family accepted to no gebrokst, all the recipes out the window, because they want the daughter to come home for Pesach. They're not coming home. He can't eat in the house. So they changed the whole minute just that the daughter could come home. It is there. And not everyone's willing to give that up. It is very chashuv. Very few people are like that. No, I think it's something you have to know up front and be accept that you know what you're getting into.
But let's say someone's like in-laws don't want to switch their house.
Let's say a girl is a Sephardi girl and grew up eating rice on Pesach. And she's all these rice recipes, but she's dating a boy who's Ashkenazi. She's got to know it's going to go. That's it. No more rice on Pesach.
Do you think that's the reason for them not to get...
Personally? No, I don't think. But it's something. Some people get very emotionally connected to their canals on Pesach. So they have to know up front. Minhagim, Nusach Davin, Ashna, Sfarad, Sfardi. These are things they have to be resolved, and it should not be a fight after you get married.
What goes against? You're not allowed to eat rice anymore unless you're an Ashkenazi boy. Why would the discussion?
Are you willing to accept that?
So then don't marry him.
All right. Or don't date him if that's a problem.
But you could keep your job anymore.
No, you can't. Unless your husband says it's fine by me.
Then he can't go to bed.
He has to give a shush. And tell him before he buys the machzor.
Crazy enough that he says,
I don't care.
Is it, like, could you say that it's like a gnai and a boy? If he doesn't care for her to keep off, like,
her
minhagim? Does that show anything about, like...
That he wants her to keep his minhagim?
If he doesn't care for her to keep off her minhagim.
I don't understand how you're wording it. He wants her to keep his minhagim, or he doesn't care if she keeps her old minhagim?
He doesn't care if she keeps her old minhagim.
There's no problem with that. It makes life easy. He's easy going. Now, again, you have to know what if a kashu is, or it has to do with davening. Like, I don't see why would a boy care if he davens svarad, that he insists on davening svarad? He davens ashkenaz. By Sephardim, they're more Machmed. The boys who are Sephardi want their wives to daven Sephardi.
What? So what do you teach your kids to do if you both daven differently?
Father's minig. Or the same way. The girls daven the mother's minig, and the boys daven the father's
minig. Well, that's what happened to me. The school I went to, Bezakh in Toronto, said more stuff than I said at home, and then I came here and we didn't say it, and then I found out I was never really supposed to
say
in the first
place.
It was just confusing.
I feel that by the time a kid's in fifth grade, it's when you start davening your own. In school, let them learn whatever they're teaching in school. Once you're in fifth grade, around then, fifth, sixth, when you start davening your family minig. But, I don't think it's a problem if it's something like that. If it's gebrokst, if the boy says, oh, we don't need canales, but since you do, we'll study in canales. That could be a problem. That could be a problem.
Really?
What?
What about, like, the Shabbos candles?
That's a minor thing. I don't think that's an issue.